Okay, right, Majjhima 31, Chula Gosinga Sutta. Now this sutta reports the Buddha visiting a group of three monks who live together harmoniously. So some good news for a change. This discourse has a parallel in the Majjhima Agama, so only one parallel version. And both versions narrate the Buddha, who is paying a visit to the monks Anuruddha, Nandi, and Kimbila, inquiring if they're not lacking anything and if they're living together in harmony. Okay, this is the basic theme of the sutta. Now, this sutta belongs to a quite complex cluster of texts. These ones which we have in front of us, being some, the Chula Gosinga Sutras, and then we have the Upakilesa Sutta, which is Majjhima, 128. I'm just seeing if there's Majjhima 128, if I've got that here. Majjhima 128. Now, the Upakilesa Sutta has a parallel in the Majjhima Agama and in the Akotara Agama. Right? And the first part of that also has counterparts in the Dharmaguptaka, Mahishasika, Mulasarvastivada, and Theravada Vinayas. Okay, so we've now got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 texts, okay, all dealing with the same event more or less in one way or another, okay, and there's probably more. For example, the Mulasarvastivada we have in Chinese, Tibetan, and possibly in Sanskrit versions as well. So I'm not going to go through all of these versions right now, but with such a great complexity of texts, then of course we can expect to have similar kinds of textual problems that we've been encountering all the way along. Now this particular one, the Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila seem to be very good friends and living together and practicing well. As a bit of a background, a similar event is told in the Upakilesa Sutta, but in the Upakilesa Sutta we're given more of the background events, which was actually the quarrel at Kosambi. So we can see how one of the major themes of this sutra is harmony, the Sangha living together in harmony and so on. And it seems to be in a deliberate contrast with the events of the quarrel at Kosambi. So I might just read that. Well, because some of that, now this is from the Vinaya Kandakas, chapter 10 of the Pali Kandakas, the Kosambi Kandaka. Now, we read last week, or last session, there was a sutta was about Devadatta, yeah? And also his quarrels and schism that he formed, and this also is found in another chapter in the Kandaka. So again, I wonder why that it's a coincidence. We have two suttas so close to each other in the Majjhima Nikaya, both of them dealing with events which are the only two chapters dealing with schism, or just about the only two chapters dealing with schism in the Kandaka, which is kind of interesting. Now, there are the timing. We can perhaps tease out a few hints as to the actual chronology of events here, which is a bit unusual in the suttas, because when Anuruddha and the other Sakyan princes were said to go forth, as we read the other week, it said in that first rains retreat that they went forth, that Bhadriya got the threefold knowledge, Anuruddha got the divine eye, Ananda got the fruit of stream entry, and Devadatta got the Patujana psychic powers. Now the fact that Anuruddha is listed as getting the divine eye suggests that he wasn't yet an arahant, because if he was an arahant they would have said that. But in the current sutta he is an arahant, okay? So obviously the current sutta must be later than that event. Now in the Upakilesa Sutta he's also still not an arahant, he's still struggling with his meditation, okay? Now if he'd already mastered the divine eye after his first rains retreat, yeah, and he was obviously one of the most talented meditators in the whole of the Sangha, then one can't imagine that the Upakilesa Sutta could have been given very late in his life. It must have been given towards the first part of his, after he was newly ordained, because he's still really struggling with his meditation. And so that suggests that the Upakilesa Sutta was given shortly after Anuruddha was ordained. And since the Upakilesa Sutta is follows on immediately from the events in Kosambi, then that tells us that the events in Kosambi also happened at around that time, which was probably around 20 years after the Buddha's enlightenment, okay? Ish, 20 years-ish. And it also suggests that the events at Kosambi were earlier, perhaps, than the events around the schism of Devadatta, because the schism of Devadatta was associated with King Ajatasattu coming to the throne, which happened towards the end of the Buddha's life. And so it's likely that that happened later, the Kosambi incident happened earlier, and the Devadatta incident happened later.
Sorry, what is the Kosambi incident?
That's what we're just about to read right now. Yeah? Kosambi later on became quite renowned as a center. There's a lot of stories that revolve around Kosambi. And one of the stories, a whole cycle of stories about them is about the ending of the sasana. And there's a whole cycle of mythology around the ending of Buddhism is going to be caused at Kosambi, sprung out, of course, of the root of this myth. And then that story of the ending of Kosambi, which was that in the far future time when there's all this stuff goes on. Anyway, they call the monks to Kosambi for a big meeting. The king sponsors it. And the monks say, oh, there's no one pure here. And they say, okay, there's one monk who's pure here, but he's living in a cave in the Himalayas, so we have to invite him. So they invite him down. He flies with his psychic powers. He's the last arahant, and he sits in the thing. And so he has all his followers. And then there's the big study monk who also has his followers. And then the study monk says, they're about to recite the Patimokkha, and the study monk says, we can't recite the Patimokkha because there's nobody here who's pure. And then the arahant sort of stands up and says, well, since the day I've ordained, I've never transgressed the vinaya even so much as damaging a blade of grass. And the other monks think that he's putting down their monks, and they think they're putting down their monks, and they get into a terrible argument. And the argument gets worse and worse, and they end up killing each other. And all the monks in all of Buddhism end up murdering each other. And there's just nothing but dead monks there.
Monks?
Nothing mentioned about them.
This is a story.
It's not a real thing either. It's okay. It's a myth. It's a prediction of the ending of Buddhism, and it's interesting in that it represents for some Buddhists their own consciousness of how they're going to come to an end. Yeah, it's going to come to an end because of the decadence and decay of the sangha, and not because of any external forces. That's actually symbolized in the myth itself. Actually, before that, the India had been invaded and the king had to fight off the invasion and all these kinds of things, and then he was resuscitating the sasana. So it's like, you know, you can see there's no external force that's actually going to destroy the sasana, but it's only from within that it's going to decline.
The decline of Rome.
Yeah. Well, they did have a few external forces to deal with as well.
But a lot from inside.
Mm. Right.
That's terrible.
It is, yeah, the Kosambi cycle. So this mythic cycle sprung out of this particular event, which is probably the root of it. Now, I won't read through the whole chapter of this Khandaka, but just a few little things. The Lord was saying in Kosambi at Gosita's monastery, at that time a certain monk had fallen into an offence. He saw that offence as an offence, but other monks saw that offence as no offence. After a time, he saw that offence as no offence, while the other monk saw the offence as an offence.
Gotcha.
All right? Then the monk spoke to him, "You, Reverence, have fallen into an offence. Do you see it? There's no offence of mine, Your Reverences, that I can see." And then those monks, having obtained unanimity, suspended that monk for not seeing the offence. But that monk was very learned. He was an expert on the Dhamma and the Vinaya and so on. He was conscientious, scrupulous and clever. Then he formed a party, and then the other groups formed a party, and then they were back and forth and blah, 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 and going. And the interesting way is the way that the Buddha reacted to it. The Buddha thinking, the order of monks is divided. Bhinna has had a schism. Rising from his seat, he approached the monks who'd suspended that monks, and he said to them, "Do not, monks, thinking it appears so to us, deem that a monk should be suspended on every occasion." Okay? So what happened is that they thought that other monk had fallen into an offence, and it wasn't so much that that the offence itself was a problem, but the fact that he refused to acknowledge it and to see it as an offence. Now, in fact, according to the commentary, the actual offence was leaving water in the water dipper in the toilet, okay, which was an offence, okay, because the mosquitoes can breed in the water dipper. So this was supposed to be the original cause of it. the text itself doesn't tell us that, but the commentary says that. Now, the offense itself isn't the problem. The problem is that he refused to acknowledge it, okay? And so then the other monk suspended him because he refused to acknowledge his flaws. And the Buddha said, don't be in a hurry to suspend somebody just because you think that they're not going to see their offense, yeah? And so he's cautioning them. So the Buddha has given actually very powerful tools, very powerful legal apparatus in the Vinaya for dealing with monks who need to be dealt with, yeah? And they're quite potent. And if they're and the Buddha always said to use them gently, yeah. And so he's restraining them. You know, those things they can be used, but use it. Don't be in a rush to go and use it just for the sake of it. And then it goes on. This particular passage has a lot of these kinds of permutations about the different kinds of. In these things, yeah. This would be this. All this stuff would be the same for the bhikkhunis as for the bhikkhus, yeah. And it goes on. Anyway, they couldn't. Then there's a couple of nice things that the Buddha says. He says, monks, if an order is divided, if it is behaving not according to the rule, if there is unfriendliness, you should sit down at a seat thinking, at least we will not behave unsuitably to one another in gesture and in speech. We will not come to blows. Okay? At least you can do that much. It's quite nice. And then the monks coming and they're all blah, blah, blah. They come and beg the Buddha to come and solve the problem. He says, comes to them and he says, enough, monks, no strife, no quarrels, no contention, no disputing. When he had spoken thus, a certain monk who had spoke what is not Dhamma spoke thus to the Buddha, Lord, let the Lord wait. Lord, let the Lord unconcerned live on intent on abiding in ease here and now. We will be held accountable for this strife, quarrel, contention and disputing. And the Buddha said, enough. So then he goes on, then he gives. Now here we have these different variations in the text. Now this particular text in the Vinaya, he then goes on to tell a very long, what is known as an avadana, a story of the past, and the Dighayu avadana, which has been translated by Venerable Tanisura. We had a copy of it around earlier. It's one of the longest of all the avadanas found in the Pali text, certainly in the Vinaya. Now, in the other version of this event found in the Upakilesa Sutta, of course, we don't find this avadana at all. Okay. Now then, the Lord the Buddha, giving up that thing, he took his bowl and robes and went off, and then spoke the very beautiful verses, which I'll read from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation.
Which these verses are in the Dhammapada.
Verses also in the Dhammapada, so that's to add to the textual complexity. If we were going to research this properly, we'd also want to look at all the versions of the Dhammapada texts. When many voices shout at once, none considers himself a fool. Though the Sangha is being split, none thinks himself to be at fault. They've forgotten thoughtful speech. They talk obsessed by words alone. Uncurbed their mouths, they bawl at will. None knows what leads him so to act. He abused me. He struck me. He defeated me. He robbed me. In those who harbour thoughts like these, hatred will never be allayed. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbour thoughts like these, hatred will readily be allayed. For in this world, hatred is never allayed by further acts of hate. It is allayed by non-hatred. This is the fixed and ageless law. Those others do not recognise that here we should restrain ourselves, but those wise ones who realise this at once end all their enmity. Breakers of bones and murderers, those who steal cattle, horses and wealth, those who pillage the entire realm, when even these can act together, why can you not do so too? So just to interrupt here, the sentiment of that verse is exactly the same as the sentiment of the Dighayu Avadana, which is not in this section, and the Buddha draws exactly the same moral from there, and it's a story of kings and fighting and all of these kinds of things and invasion and so on. And the message here, it says, for Dira Dighayu, wrathful moods are not allayed by wrath. Wrathful moods are allayed by non-wrath. And so even kings can understand this. And so this is exactly the same message. It's very interesting. If one can find a worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with him content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. Better it is to walk alone. There is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a tusker in the woods. So after that, the Buddha left Kosambi and went to the village of Balakalonakara, which is the
Childish salt maker.
Childish salt maker, yeah. That's very good. Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned that the Buddha left straight away.
How did you know that? Sorry?
It's interesting you mentioned the Buddha left straight away. Because what he's basically saying by that gesture is that these bunch of monks are a bunch of fools and he's off.
Yeah.
Probably none of them get it.
No, they didn't seem to get it. But that I've skipped out a lot. There's a whole long process that led up to that. Yeah. He didn't just walk out right at the beginning. He tried.
Did he walk out after that monk said those non-dharma things?
So then he went and found Bhagu. So Bhagu, like the example of the monk who's living by himself and living harmonious and so on, and he went and saw him. Now then, he went to see the Anuruddhas, staying in there, or the three monks staying in the forest, and they're called Anuruddha, the Anuruddhas in plural. This is a kind of an idiom that it uses in Pali, that the group of three monks are named after their leader, so they're called like the three Anuruddhas, or the Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbila. He went to see them, and after teaching them, he taught up to the bit which we'll find again in our sutra in a little while about teaching about how they were living together harmoniously in the monastery, okay? So doing their, what in Thai they call the kor wat, and living together comfortably and so on. And that's as far as it goes. Then after that it leaves, the Vinaya version leaves that story, and then the Buddha leaves. Now in both of the sutta versions, after that bit, it then goes on to talk about the higher dhammas, the meditative attainments that they've been reaching, but the Vinaya doesn't go into that at all, okay? So the Vinaya goes, and the Buddha in the Vinaya goes off to stay in the Parileya forest, of course another very famous episode where he went to live by himself in the middle of the forest, reflecting on how comfortable he was to be living all alone there and not with all the monks who were arguing with each other. And then at the same time there was a large bull elephant, a Hati Naga, who was also beset by elephants and cow elephants, elephant calves and sucklings, and the grass was already eaten by them and they'd broken off the branches and the mud water had all been muddied and everything. And he said, what a hassle, I'm going to go off and live by myself. So he went off to live by himself also, and he saw the Buddha there. And then having approached the Buddha, he set out by means of his trunk, drinking water for the Lord and water for washing, and he kept the grass down. And it occurred to that large bull elephant, now I'm living at comfortable and at ease. Then the Buddha said the following, here now agree with the mind with mind, the sage, which is the Naga, and the bull elephant of plough pole tusks. Each delights in the forest solitude. So, and then just briefly coming back to the Kosambi incident, the Buddha, after staying in Parileya, then went to Savatthi. Then the lay followers at Kosambi thought, these monks are really dreadful. They've driven the Buddha away. Before we had the Buddha staying with us, and now he's gone. You know, we're not going to do any. We're not going to give these guys any alms food. We're not going to pay respect for them. They don't deserve it. So they stopped supporting the monks. And then the monks said, hang on, let's go to Savatthi and settle this legal question with the Buddha. So then they went to Savatthi. It's a few days' journey, not too far away. Then, when Sariputta heard that they'd come, they were coming, he asked the Buddha, all these schismatic monks are coming, what are we going to do about them? Well, said the Buddha, you take your stand on Dhamma. And then Sariputta says, well, how do I know what's Dhamma and what's not Dhamma? And so the Buddha says 18 points by which you can know what Dhamma is, not Dhamma. So if a monk is speaking or teaching, explains non-dhamma as dhamma, dhamma as non-dhamma, non-vinaya as vinaya, vinaya as non-vinaya. What was not spoken by the Tathagata as spoken by the Tathagata, what was spoken by the Tathagata as not spoken by the Tathagata, what was practiced by the Tathagata as not practiced, what was not practiced as practiced by the Tathagata, what was not laid down as laid down, what was laid down as not laid down, what is an offence as no offence, what is no offence as an offence, a light offence as a serious offence as a slight offence, an offence which can be done away with as an offence that cannot be done away with, an offence which cannot be done away with as an offence which can be done away with, a very bad offence as not very bad, or a very bad offence as very, not a very bad offence as very bad. 18 points. Okay, so without going into all the details of those things, I think you get the general idea. So the different monks came up and asked him about this, and Mahapajapati came and asked him about the same thing. The Buddha's advice to her was, well then, Gautami, listen to Dhamma from both sides. Having heard Dhamma from both sides, choose the views and the approval and the persuasion of those monks who are their speakers of Dhamma. And whatever is to be desired by the order of nuns from the order of monks, which refers to things like the fortnightly teaching and so on, all that should be desired only from one who speaks Dhamma. Okay, so it's left up to the nuns to decide about who is speaking Dhamma and who's not. The Buddha's not taking side, he's saying take your Dhamma as your standard. And he says, when Anathapindika comes and says, what should we do as the lay followers? What should we do when these quarrelling monks are coming? The Buddha says, well then, householder, give gifts to both sides. Having given dana to both sides, hear the Dhamma from both sides. Having heard the Dhamma from both sides, choose the views and the approval of those monks who are speakers of Dhamma. And Visakha came to see him, and he gave the same advice to Visakha. So a very beautiful way of handling it, isn't it? He's not picking sides. They stick to the Dhamma and listen to both sides. Yeah, very important. Yeah, that you listen to both sides before you're making up your mind. Then they say, what should we do? Where should we lodge these monks? He says, give them separate lodgings. He said, Bhante, what if there are no separate lodgings? He said, well, separate some lodgings away and give them, but don't take the kutis away from the senior monks, all right? It's a Dukkata offence. But what should we do with regard to material gains, like offerings, robes or meal offerings and things? How should we distribute them? He said, distribute them equally. Okay? So you don't make any distinction as far as distributing material gains. Then the monk...
Distribute them equally amongst all.
Right. Then the monk afterwards had felt remorse and saw his offence and so on, and it was all settled. So this is the Kosambi incident in brief.
That's quite difficult advice, I think, to treat both sides equally with food and stuff.
Mm.
Because you would, being human, you would have your opinions already. And you wouldn't really want to give the best food to this one, perhaps.
Yeah.
But to give both equally is...
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So that would soften them up for the right decision about the Dhamma.
Yeah. This is very interesting to see the way the Buddha handles these kinds of disputes.
Like every human being deserves respect, whether you eat
right.
Dhamma or not.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, they've still got to eat. You know?
The Buddha said to the lay followers to dana, to both, either speak or not speak of them.
Yeah.
To both?
Give to both. Just the same.
But not speak of them, right?
Yeah.
But they are still monks?
Yeah.
But didn't he say, I think he's indicating that you feed both sides, then you listen to what each side has to say.
Mm.
The ones who you think are teaching Dhamma, then you further support them. The other ones you can...
Oh, no, it didn't say further support. It gives alms equally. But just says you follow their teachings. You know?
The ones who are teaching Dhamma.
Who ones are teaching Dhamma, yeah.
Otherwise we get into situations like in Sri Lanka in the good old days where it's against the law to give monks, to give Dhamma to other monks of Yavai Giri Monastery.
Mm.
Get fined.
Really? That's pretty bad. It's obviously not in the spirit of the rule. Yeah.
And it tackles the obvious problem of duality, you know, or as of like good and bad,
mm.
this and that.
Yeah.
And plus, it takes the development. developmental approach, which is maybe you're not teaching Dharma, but you can.
Right.
Either,
yeah.
Supported and
yeah.
given the right friendship.
Yeah.
You can, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
What happens a lot is that people come and say, oh yeah, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even if some of the things they're teaching is not Dharma, there's probably some that is. It's rarely they find someone who's completely teaching non-Dharma. So they try, but you can only get so far.
And what the Buddha said about, you know, not to act in haste.
This
is going back a little while. One passage that you were reading is you exercise authority to exclude, you know, not to,
yep.
not to be hasty.
Yep.
So just see how it unfolds and helps you see that.
Yeah. And that's found in several different places in the suttas, similar kinds of things, where the Buddha's urging the monks to use those vinaya procedures kindly and gently, and not to be in haste. You know, if there's young monks who don't have much faith and so on, yet don't be in a hurry to prosecute them if they just do small things and things like that. Yeah, and I think this is what you know, matches up nicely with what Bhikkhu Bodhi was saying in his article at the Bhikkhuni Congress, where he was saying, you know, use vinaya in a kind way. You know, correctness is one thing, but kindness is also part of it. You know, and
Because the Buddha was also outlining as an opportunity for reconciliation. If you feed or support both groups, there's an opportunity for them to actually become non-schismatic and to rejoin the Sangha,
right.
unified, but if you don't support ones, then they just drop away.
Ah, and it becomes worse and worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just more anger, more friction.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it tends to gather momentum like a boulder rolling down a mountain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can see that in Thailand where the forest monks get more support and where the city monks are quite jealous and they
yeah.
cause lots of problems for them because of that reason.
Yeah. Okay, so to come back to the Chula Gosinga Sutta. Okay, so the Buddha was staying at Nadika at the brick house. Now then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to the park of the Gosinga Sala tree wood. Sorry, I should mention, having given that background, it's not at all clear to what extent the events here are given in very much the same words as we find in the Upakilesa Sutta and this passage in the Vinaya, but it's obviously a different historical event in that the monks are now enlightened, and so it's not clear what the actual historical situation. It seems unusual, to say the least, that exactly the same preliminary events would have happened in that case. But anyway, it was evening. The Blessed One arose from meditation and went to the park of the Gosinga Sala tree wood. The park keeper saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and told him, "Do not enter this park, recluse. There are three clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them." And so I'm wondering where we can get a park keeper like that for our monastery. Tash, you interested? Danny used to do that role when he was here. He was really good at it. He'd put his kind of big overcoat on and he'd have his kind of long hair and he's kind of really tall and stuff, and he'd sort of lurk around and kind of glare at people when they came in. They were like, Then the Venerable Anuruddha heard the park keeper speaking to the Blessed One and told him, "Friend park keeper, do not keep the Blessed One out. It is our teacher, the Blessed One, who's come." And the Venerable Anuruddha went to Venerable Nanda and Venerable Kimbila and said, "Come out, Venerable Sirs, come out, our teacher, the Blessed One, has come." Then all three went to see the Blessed One. One took his bowl and outer robe, one prepared a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. According to some schools of Buddhism, like the Lokuttaravada, the Buddha he would never get dirty, but he would just wash his feet in order to conform with the ways of the world. Okay, but according to the text, it looks like he just had dirty feet. I don't know. Then those three Venerable Ones paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. I like my Buddha with dirty feet anyway. When they were seated, the Blessed One said to them, "I hope you are all keeping well, Anuruddha. I hope you're all comfortable. I hope you're not having any trouble getting alms food." Okay, so here, this is Kachi wo Anuruddha. So here's this plural usage of Anuruddha I mentioned before. So the three Anuruddhas. It's just an idiom. Kachi wo Anuruddha kamaniyang. So are you Kanti? Is the word from Kanti? Are you bearing up? Are you accept? Is it acceptable for you? Gachi yapaniyang, similar meaning. Gachi bendakena na kilamata. Is there no hassle about alms food? Bendakena. And they replied, Kamaniyang bhante yapaniyang bhante natramayang bhante bendakena kilamati. Okay. So, I hope, Anuruddha, that you're all living in concord with mutual appreciation. Samagga sammodamana. So here's a mutual appreciation. Moda is the same as anumodana, rejoicing in each other. Avivadamana, not disputing. Kirodaki bhuta, like milk, kira, and water, udaka. Blending like milk and water. Anyamanyang. Anya? Anya. Anya? The other? The other. One looking at the other. Anyamanyang means mutual. Mutually. Bia chakuhi means friendly eyes or fondness, with eyes of fondness. That you're looking at each other with eyes of fondness or kindness.
That's nice, but I'm not this. That
they were. Anyamanya.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyamanya. And then, so that was kachi. And then he replies, tagha, tagha. Absolutely. Surely, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord. And then, how? Yatakatang, how do you live in concord and harmony?
What's the word for harmony?
Samagga. And then here, but, sorry?
Does that mean the same path?
No, not. It's not magga as in path. It's the agga as in point, as in one pointedness. The M is a sandhi, or no, this is part of the sum meaning together, agga. So one, yeah, it's like together, bringing all together as one or something. Yeah. Here it occurs to us. It is a gain for me. It is a great gain for me. That I have such eva rupehi, of such a sort, eva rupa. Here, rupa not meaning body and not meaning sight or things that you see. This kind of context, eva rupa, means of such a kind. Okay? Tata rupa, of this kind, eva rupa, of such a kind. Eva rupa rupehi, sabrahmachari, some companions in the holy life. So, brahmachari is a holy liver, not the body part liver, but one who's living a holy life. And sa means together. Yeah? Sabrahamachari hi sadhing, also together. So this is emphasizing sabrahamachari hi sadhing. I'm living together with such companions in the holy life. Then, regarding these venerables, okay, so here is the locative in the sense of about or referring to these venerables. Metang kaya kamang pachupatitang. So I establish loving bodily acts, kind bodily acts, both in public, avi, in public, cheva rohocha, and in private. And the same with acts of speech and acts of mind, both in public and in private. Then it occurs to me, why do I not, having nikipitwa, having tossed away my own mind, yannunahang sakangchitang nikipitwa, having thrown out my own mind, right? Imesan yeva ayasmantanang chittasa vasena vateyanti. Why don't I live according to the will or the wish of these other venerables? Okay? The minds of these other venerables. And then, so that's first of all, that occurs to me. And then, not only does it occur to me, not only do I think that, but then I in fact do toss aside my own mind and then live according to the wishes of these other venerables' minds. Nana hiko, many. Nana, as in what nana chart? Many countries. Okay? Nana chant is many countries. Nana, many. Nana hi ko bhante kaya. Our body is a many. Kancha panamanye chittanti. But it seems as if, or one would think, that we are one in mind.
What's ime samya eva?
This is the eva. Is the emphatic particle, right? So here, having tossed aside my own mind, then just in the same way, or indeed, or something like that, you translate eva. Okay, y is just a sandhi consonant, but it's commonly used with eva. It's just there for the sound, really. It doesn't change the meaning. Ime sang means is the plural form of the demonstrative particle. So this means them. Okay. But here it's the genitive form, so it's of them. Okay? So, of those venerables. So, it's the same meaning as there. Of them. In plural.
T-H-E-I-R.
Yeah. T-H-E-I-R, yeah. There. So, Nesang means there. And then Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbila repeat the same thing, and so this is how we dwell. The Buddha replies, Sadhu, sadhu, anuruddha. Gacchi panavo anuruddha appamatta atapino pahitatta viharathati. But, anuruddhas, pana hearing, meaning having a sense of but. Do you dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute? But how do you dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute? But do you dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute? And they reply, Gaga! Absolutely, Mayam Bhante, we dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute. Then how? Yata katam pana, but, here pana again meaning but, yata katam, how, but how do you dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute? Now, Venerable Analia has a comment on this one. After they've had up to now, that the Chinese version is very similar to the Pali, but in this one, now it goes on to talk about their lifestyle, okay, which we'll talk about. It was a very beautiful passage, but in the Chinese version, it instead goes straight on to talk about their meditation here. And Venerable Nalio gives about, it looks like about 20 or 30 passages from the suttas where this kind of phrase, dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute, is used in the context of doing especially intensive meditation practice. And so he suggested the Chinese version has the description of their lifestyle as part of the introduction to the sutta. It still has it there, but it's part of the introduction rather than being the answer to this particular question. It's a bit disappointing because I quite like it, having it as it is, but he seems to have a point. Anyway, here, Bhante. Now, whoever of us is the first from the village for alms to return. Pati kamati. Pati, we, kamati, come. We come back from alms round. Gamato is the ablative, from the village. Okay? The first, the pataman. Then they set out, panyapeti, the seats. Paniyang paribhojaniyang upatthapeti, and they set up the drinks and the paribhojaniyang, the edibles. Avakarapating upatthapeti, which is the, I have to look at some of these words.
Wouldn't the edibles be the same as the arms?
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, I was just wondering about that myself. Paniyang paribhojaniyang, it has the water for drinking and for washing. Yeah. So maybe bhojana normally means eating or edibles, paniyang bhojaniyang. But here it has the water for drinking and for washing. So maybe an explanation of that, I'm not sure. It puts the refuse bucket in its place. Avatarapating. Okay. And whoever comes last, the pacha, from the village, gamato, The ato here meaning from, ablative sense, returns. If they have leftovers from, if there is anything left over from the meal, so if the other monks have left over anything from their meal, sacheya kankati bhunjati. If he wants, he eats. If he doesn't want, then where there is little grass, he throws it away, or where there is no, where there's water with no,
nothing
there's nothing living in there, he tips it out.
Does that mean little fish, or what? How does that fix dead water?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure. This is always a slightly curious phrase. I mean, obviously the intent is that the food should be disposed of properly and carefully and not in a way that's going to cause a mess and all of these kinds of things. And that's certainly understandable in terms of disposing of it on land, that obviously you don't want rats and all of these kinds of things coming. But for disposing it in water, I mean, I have to admit, when we stayed at Phu Chom we used to wash our bowls next to the stream. And there are all these little fishy kins in the streams, and we used to throw our bowl washing water in there, and they always used to love coming up and eating our little grains of rice and things like that. And we never felt guilty about it.
Naturally, when you read about going camping, uh-huh, you should wash your bowl not directly in the water.
Uh-huh.
Because some of that stuff isn't good for what's living in the water.
Yeah.
So the Buddha maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, so but it's interesting, you know, just that refinement of care about just those little things, you know.
How would you find dead water?
I just look around. So asana, and then they put away the seats and they put away the water for drinking water and using water, and they put away the rubbish bin. Bhattagang sammajjati. And he sweeps out the refectory. And whoever sees the drinking water vessel, the pot, should probably be like a clay pot, like they still use, or the pot for usage. Oh, okay, so this is why the usage thing comes in here, because it's clear later on. So here is the gata, it clearly means a pot. And so the paribhojani gata must mean the pot for general usage. Okay, the paniya gata is the drinking water, and the bhojaniya gata is the general usage. A lot of these are probably terms which you find more in the Vinaya than in the suttas, and a lot of these words I'm not particularly familiar with. And the vacha gata is literally the poo pot, which is probably the water pot for the toilet. And if it's ritang tuchang, if it's empty, then he gets it ready, fills it. And then if this for him is avisayang, if he's not capable of it, then hatavikarena, then with a motion of the hand, he calls a second, and hatavilanghakena, and they move it by joining their hands. Not dueva mayang bhante tapate avatang bhindama, but we do not break into speech for that reason. Okay, so just to get somebody to help out with doing a simple task, then there's no need to be breaking into speech.
Is that not against touching each other? Joining hands
like that? Well, they're probably like joining hands on the pot, but there's no reason why monks shouldn't touch each other.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't talk about sexual orientation
and those. Yeah. So, but we did understand the message implied by this particular passage, did we not? Does anyone care to paraphrase for me?
Well, you do it.
Monks with this sort of level of attainment, I'm going to be too hung up on sexual preferences and tendencies.
No, I wasn't talking about that. That was entirely Eva's
speech. It wasn't necessary. But they did spend hours talking about Dharma once.
Yeah. But for doing little chores and things when they're working and so on in the monastery, they didn't feel necessary to maintain a constant banter of inane rubbish, which was filling the ears of all the people around them with mindless gibberish.
And Gary can talk.
I didn't say that either. I never said that. And
well, I made it respectable.
Yeah. So we perhaps might want to investigate our own conduct in that regard.
Dear, oh dear. It's a nice shooter.
Don't shoot the messenger either.
Pancha, okay. So every panchaha, every 5 days, then we the whole night we sit and discuss Dhamma. So I must say we're fairly slack because last night we only sat up till midnight talking about Dhamma. So we're doing very badly.
I was glad to see you have a good night's sleep.
We'll have to do it longer in the future. Okay. So every 5 days. So that would coordinate with the Uposatha days, because the Uposatha days work on a 15-day cycle. This is how we dwell. So it's very lovely, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, and no one talks about it, and everybody does their job. And it's not different jobs. Mm. One person does a lot.
Yeah, and it's not based on anything, just on whoever's there, you know. If you get back first from your arms around, then you just do what's the duty for that, you know. You don't. Sadhu, sadhu, Anuruddha, says the Buddha. There, but for you dwelling like this, have you any uttarimanusa dhamma, beyond the human dhammas, alamariya, sufficient, enough for the Aryan noble and noble, sorry, Aryan knowledge and vision, a distinction. Okay, so a thing, Dhamma, a Dhamma which is beyond the human, which is a distinction of knowledge and vision which is suitable for the noble ones, something like that. Have you got it? Adhigato, attained it, pasaviharo, and a comfortable abiding.
Is that comfortable abiding, that one word?
Pasu is comfortable. Pasu viharodi. Kinhinosiya bante. Okay? Kinhinosiya bante. Why not? Why wouldn't we? Okay? No, is it kind of an idiom? Siya is actually the optative form of the verb atti, believe it or not. So when we say atti, there is, okay, so ati is there is, and here it's in a question form, so is there, okay, and here is, this is the actual reply to that verb, and there would be, but it's an optative form, normally meaning there would, or would there be, okay, there would. So here you translate it as something, king is the question word, so you translate it as something like, why wouldn't we? Okay. Idha mayang bhante yavadeva akankama. Here we bhante, as much as we wish, akankama, whenever we want. Viviceva kame hi vivicha kusale hi dhamehi savitakang savicharang vivekajam piti sukhang patamang jhanang upasampadya viharama. We get into the first jhana. Then this is how we dwell with our uttarimanusa dhammas. Sadhu, sadhu, Anuruddha. But Anuruddha, are there any more stuff that you've got? He says, oh, well, why not? He said, whenever we want to, we get into the second jhana. Okay? Obviously, I've did the first jhana twice and thing. And then he says, is there anything more? He says, yeah, of course, whenever we want, we get into the third jhana. And he says, oh, whenever we want, we get into the fourth jhana. And base of infinite space. And the base of infinite consciousness. And the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And then he says, having transcended the base of neither perception nor non-perception, we enter and abide in the base of the cessation, in the cessation of perception and feeling. And then with wisdom, having seen with wisdom, the defilements are destroyed. But he says, Bhante, further than this dwelling, we don't see anything better. Okay. Actually, the Buddha's question, I should have pointed this out, do you see any other kind of Uttarimanusa Dhamma, which is Patipasadhiya, which is more tranquil, Pasadhi? Okay. So this is his question. So we don't see anything which is more tranquil than this dwelling. And we don't see any other than this pleasant abiding. We don't see any other pleasant abiding which is higher or more sublime. And the Buddha replies, of course, sadhu, sadhu. And he says, you're right, there is in fact no pleasant abiding which is higher or more sublime than that pleasant abiding.
This must be the absolutely most perfect answer any teacher might get from his disciples.
Yeah.
This whole thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely the most perfect.
Yeah.
But isn't it the same group who he scolds previous times, or he gives a discourse about seeing shapes and forms and being percipient of this?
Ah, yeah, he's not really scolding, but he's encouraging them. Yeah, encouraging them, yeah.
So
obviously.
Meditation ain't that good at that time.
Yeah.
It's a
upakilesa sutta, yeah.
So it's exactly the same group.
It's the same group, obviously, at an earlier stage. Mm. Yeah,
upakilesa sutta. Do you think Buddha would have been glowing happy?
Oh, yeah.
In an equanimous sort of way.
No, I think it would have shown. He might have even patted them and said, wow.
Okay. Now, when the Buddha had instructed them and so on, and then he left, and then Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbula said to Venerable Anuruddha, we're now at section 20, page 304, section 20. They said, have we ever reported to the Venerable Anuruddha that we've obtained those abidings and attainments that the Venerable Anuruddha in the Blessed One's presence ascribed to us, right up to the destruction of the defilements? Okay, so Evamarujimha, have you ever described those things? And he says, no, you've never told me these things. But by encompassing the minds of the Venerable One's minds with my mind, Chetasa Cheto Paritsa Vidito, and then I knew, and also I was told by Devas, Devatapime Etamatangaru Chesung. Okay. Then I declared it when directly questioned. So they were sitting around discussing Dhamma all night, every five nights as they're living together, but they never actually sort of, you know, boasting to each other about their attainments and stuff. One wonders how they were discussing
it.
It's
amazing, isn't it?
They're obviously gentlemen of restraint and circumspection.
They didn't even try to guess.
They didn't even try. It doesn't say that they didn't try to guess. He did, well, he obviously did. He read their minds. He didn't have to guess, did he?
No, I mean each other when they were talking together. Have we ever reported to the, you know, Venerable
One? You mean they didn't play, let's guess what you've got? If they were able to read each other's minds, they probably didn't have to.
But maybe they're discussing Dhamma, that would be a part of the discussion. And rather than saying, I have attained this, they would say, I'm a recipient of light and all this sort of stuff, or. And it would become obvious during the discourse that practicing along that sort of way.
Yeah.
Maybe they're talking less about their meditation things and rather more about Dhamma.
Yeah, they maybe just not talking in such a personal way about them. So, next little bit, which is also quite nice. Oh, so just to mention that we talked a little bit earlier that a few weeks ago, that in the Chinese or the Sarvastivadin versions, where the Pali has the four jhanas and four formless attainments, the Chinese versions usually include the four Brahma viharas also, having a total of 12 attainments. And so in this case also, this is another one of those situations where the Brahma viharas are brought in the Chinese version. And the other difference with the Chinese version is that they don't mention the cessation of perception and feeling, but mention the six supernormal knowledges, the six abhinya. And again, that's quite a common difference between the Sarvastivadin and the Pali Sutta. Then, Diga Parajana, the Yaka, approached the Blessed One. Now, this is a somewhat strange name. I think. Diga means long. Parajana means alien.
Other something.
Other person. Outsider. The long alien yaka.
So it's just an alien red. Pop down into spaceships, let's go.
Commanders of the yakas, okay. So a yaka commander. Now, because we're used to thinking of yakas as being kind of revolting and ugly.
Child-eating monsters.
Yeah, child-eating monsters and stuff. Which I think is perhaps not such an undeserved reputation. But they're not always seen in that way, and actually the yuccas are seen in a number of different ways. This is just the first page. If you just Google yaksha and Google images, and here's some of the yakshas which come up, so you get some idea of how they've been represented. So this is more like an ancient Indian one. It's like a kind of a dwarf kind of thing. And this is a contemporary Thai yaksha, where they're still pretty ugly faces, but they're like a guardian demon. This is a Goodman Gaines. I guess this is like a representation of a yaksha in some kind of fantasy game or something. Yeah, then you have the famous Yakshini, who... the Kunti and so on. Should I show a picture of Kunti? That might be a bit provocative, but here Kunti, he's a seated male. They're probably supposed to be yaksha. They're often they're in. This is another yaksha. He is like a hero kind of thing. So you wonder whether they're in some ways they're similar to the heroes of the Greek mythology. Here's another yaksha. They're not all kind of terrible ogres or anything at all. You know, they're often quite quite okay, and I guess in some cases they're real horrible ogres. But in some, and so here, this is a Greek scroll supported by an Indian yaksha. So this is a Greek-Indian hybrid. Kunti is the name of a yakshini, but she's also the mother of the Pandavas in the Mahabharata. So this is Harati, another yakshini, Buddhist. So she started life as this cannibalistic demon, right, in Rajagaha, who used to eat all these children, but she loved her own children, but used to eat all the children of others, and the Sakyamuni stole Aiji, was that his name, the youngest of Harati's sons, and hid him under his rice bowl. Harati, this is a Japanese word for Harati, desperately searched around for his sister, her missing son, throughout the universe, and finally pleaded to the Buddha for help. The Buddha pointed out that she was suffering because she lost one of hundreds of children, and asked if she could imagine the suffering of parents whose only child had been devoured. She replied contritely that their suffering must be many times greater than hers, and vowed to protect all children.
It sounds rather Mahayanish, because it allows the Buddha the opportunity to go stealing children in order to teach somebody else a lesson.
That's like a Greek thing.
Yes, this one here is a Greek image from Gandhara, and this is. There's a whole genre of stories featuring cannibalistic yakinis who become and yakas, but also the yakinis who become adopted into Buddhism. And it seems that previously they would have been fertility goddesses to whom the local children would have sacrificed their children. Okay, so there would have been a cult of child sacrifice for ensuring fertility. And so the Buddhist kind of rationalistic way of adopting these cults would have been to tell some kind of story like this and say, well, previously, yes. So it's not saying your religion is wrong, right? They're saying, yes, your religion is quite right, you know. There is this goddess, and she does all do all these things, and you know, all these things. But now she's changed. Now she's converted, and she's become a Buddhist. So you don't have to sacrifice your children anymore. And she's now become the good guy, and now in fact she's the patron saint of easy childbirth, yeah. And so what they would do is they would then set up an image of Hariti or Kunti or one of these deities in the shrine, okay, in the temple, Okay, so there would be a shrine for Hari Tejas. We have our goddess Bodhisattva down there. They would put up a shrine somewhere in the temple, and so all the villagers would come, and when they wanted their childbirth or whatever, and they would make offerings and so on, and then this would, so then they would adopt it within the Buddhist monasteries. And this was quite a very widespread phenomenon, and you see it even today. You see, of course, all the yuccas and things within the Buddhist temples.
This is how the development of Tibetan in some Chinese temples, I suppose, come about, by taking on elements of animism and shamanism, and
yep.
and then saying, yes, but the Buddha embraces this as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To get them on side. And
absolutely, yeah. So this is how they do it.
The PR campaign.
In the second picture, though.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a minute. But, sorry?
Hindu gods and Buddhist temples in Sri Lanka.
Ah, yeah, yeah, very common. Sometimes you can't find Buddhist ones.
this sort of story is quite true in spiritual terms, in terms of people care for their own kids but don't, unable to care for other people's kids in half the same way.
Mm.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's quite psychologically true, yeah. So the other interesting thing about this is when I followed up in my little essay about it, but there's also this allowance after this story, and then there became this allowance where the women in the village said, well, we want Hariti to now look after our children. It's almost like they still wanted to continue this practice of offering their children to the monastery. So previously it would have been child sacrifice. But what they did instead was that they would bring their children to the monastery and leave them there for a period of time, maybe a few weeks. And their kids would actually live in the monastery, right? And there's this whole series of rules in the Mulasarvastivadin Vinaya about all the exceptions and allowances which the monks have to make for all these kids living in the monastery. You know, what happens if the kids want to have some food in the afternoon? The Buddha says, oh, all right, go on, give them something to eat in the afternoon, you know? And there's this whole kind of series of allowances. And what happened also is they make offerings, because it seems that the lay people would then make offerings for the performance of this, you know. So it was obviously was a source of revenue for the monasteries. And so there seems to have been a practice which developed as a result of this kind of yakshini cult of actually taking your children to the monastery and leaving them there for periods of time, which is very much like what they do today in Theravada with the temporary ordinations. Yeah, it's exactly what you do. You take your sons along for the school holidays or something like that, and then they ordain for a few weeks and so on, and then they come away, and the parents make offerings to the monastery and things like that. So this may have been where this practice originated. So I can't avoid showing you this one, but this is a very, very provocative image of Hariti, and this, you can see the obvious Greek symbolism here, the cornucopia, being a classic Greek image of fertility, and Hariti and her husband.
Who's the ones that they're standing on?
These are other yuccas.
Children,
these are children who are climbing up, but they're also sitting on yuccas. So this is from Gandhara. Hmm.
Gandhara being in India, isn't it?
The northwestern corner of India, yeah. The Greek area. It's where the first Greek style images were. So here she's... She's assimilated with Tycho, the Greek goddess. So there you go. So these yuccas are more complex than we think. They're not just these kind of horrible monsters. Now, anyone who wants to find out more about yuccas, I can hardly recommend this book highly enough. This has some fantastic Buddhist and Vedic studies by Vijayasekara. Has some fantastic essays on things like yuccas and the Rigvedic river goddesses and the Indus Valley seals and the Gandharva and Pali Gandhaba, where he argues that the Pali word Gandhaba is actually cognate with the Greek word Kantaura, meaning centaur, in Greek Kantaura, in Sanskrit Gandharva, and then a whole socio-semantic analysis of the Sanskrit kalp, which is the word we use for Gapyankarohi. So when we say Gapyankarohi for the fruit, we can not only do that, we can do it with a socio-semantic analysis as well, which is great. So highly recommended. And here he goes into all of the roots and references to yaksha from the earliest references in the Rig Veda. And it seems that the earliest meaning was something, perhaps something like, it's very difficult to tease out what the original meaning of it was, because in the Vedas it's very hard to figure out from the context, but perhaps had a meaning, an original meaning of to rush after or hunt or injure. This is one suggestion. Or else, so it has that sense of stirring or energy, so like rousing up of energy and moving in energy. And also perhaps had a sense of like the, it seems to be assimilated with the sun, and like the Hiranyagarbha, or the sun as the source of wonder and light. And so these are kind of some of the similes or some of the implications in the yakha. And so it has these different kinds of senses, and one of the senses it means is just of like a spirit, and perhaps originally just the spirit of a departed one would be called a yakha, and so on. So anyone's interested, that's a highly recommended book. So here we have this case where this yakha is obviously not a child-eating ogre, although he may have been in the past. He's now been converted to Buddhism, and now he's coming and saying, "Oh, it's wonderful. It's a gain for the Vajjians." So presumably, where these monks are staying is in the Vajjian Republic. It's a great gain for the Vajjians that the Tathagata accomplished and fully enlightened dwells among them, and that these three clansmen, the Venerable Anuruddha, Nandi, and Kimbila. Okay, so when they heard this, then the earth devas heard it, and then up through the various orders of devas, just as we found in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and then right up as far as the Brahma world, then the fame of these three monks have left. So this is a bit of bad news for those monks who imagined that they could live in peace and obscurity just by sitting and meditating quietly in the forest. No, your fame will be spread about as far as the Brahma realms, okay? So, bad luck.
People hassling you at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, there's devas coming down and waking you up with their bright lights. So, now, and the Buddha says, that ev metang diga. Thus it is. Okay, for in whatever the family, the from whatever family these such monks would have gone forth, then they would with pasanna cittang, with a mind of faith, would recollect or think of them, then that would for a long time be for their benefit and happiness. Okay, and not only for the family, but also the kula pariwata, the family circle. Okay, so this is like the broader family, and then same for the gama, the village, and then the nigama, the town, the nagara, the city, the janapada, the country. So these same words we found again in this kind of sequence.
Just thinking about humble power of purity. If you have three pure beings, our whole country can contemplate, and that it brings happiness and well-being. It's really
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But they have to participate. Like, it's not just good enough for the three beings to sort of sit there and then spread metta and then do it all themselves, right? The other guys have to actually take part. If they ignore it and forget about it and don't worry about the three, then it's not going to do any good. Yeah. Well, it's up to the others. They have to actually actively recollect those three monks and think about them, reflect on them, and then rejoice in it. Yeah. So if all the Katiyas were to recollect them, then for all the Katiyas it would be a good for their benefit and happiness. Diga ratang, for a long time. Diga long ratta night. But it's used in idiom in Pali to mean a long time. If all the Brahmanas, all the Vesas, the merchants, or the middle class, and the Suddhas, the working class, were to recollect, then that would be for their happiness and well-being. If, Diga, this world with its gods and its maras and its brahmins and its ascetics and brahmins in this generation with its princes and people were to recollect these Kulaputtas with Kulaputta, the sons of families, with a mind of faith, then this would be for a long time for the benefit and happiness of this world with its devas and its maras and its brahmas and its ascetics and brahmins in this generation with its princes and people. Okay. Sadeva.
Yeah, the last line of the first paragraph.
What do you think it means?
Peoples, I thought we were up to.
Deva, sa, is with. Deva means either deva or it means kings in this case, or royalty. Manusa, humans.
Like they combine Mara with
Brahma. Yeah, good question. Alokasa Samara Kasa Brahma Kasa. Well, the Maras, in one sense, obviously, are supposed to be the bad guys, but they're also supposed to be very powerful devas, and so they're always kind of included in this list. Some cases it seems more appropriate than others. For example, like in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and the Buddha says, you know, I've turned this wheel of Dhamma and it can't be turned back by any Deva or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. So in that context, it makes perfect sense because the Mara can't undo the teaching. Yeah, but in this kind of context, perhaps, he's holding out hope for the Maras. Maybe Mara's going to think, oh, sadhu, these wonderful monks, they're practicing. Stranger things have happened. And they did, in fact, happen in the Sarvastivadin scriptures. Okay. See, Diga, how these Kulaputtas are practicing for the benefit of the many folk. Bahu jana. Bahu, many, jana, folk. For the happiness, for the sukha of the bahu jana. Loka anukampakaya, for compassion, anukampa, for the world. For the benefit, I can't say benefit, it has also benefit. So the welfare, huh? Welfare and happiness of the many, for the good, he translates here, good, or welfare, benefit, and happiness of gods and people. Bahudana hitaya, bahudana sukhaya. That's what the Blessed One said. And then the Diga Parajana, the long alien spirit, rejoiced in the Blessed One's world.
What's Idama Voka? We've had that before.
Vocha, Eva. You should know that by now.
Yes, I know it. I've been using that.
Thus, this was said. Avocha is said. It's a past tense. This was said by the Blessed One. There are, but it's particularly emphasized here. Yeah. I mean, it is a quality which is mentioned many times and emphasized many times. But this is probably the nicest passage just to talk about it. It's very simple, and just the humility of the monks. You know, they're just living there and doing their meditation, and it's just the whole setting is just very nice. And the park keeper saying, "Oh, please don't come in. The monks are meditating." He says, "Oh, come on, it's the Buddha. Let him in." And so he comes in and says, "Oh, are you living diligent?" So it's almost, that's why I quite like the way the Pali presents it, because it's almost like, "Are you living diligent?" It's almost like he expects them to talk about their meditation, and because of their humility, they say, "Oh, yes, we set out the seats and we do the water thing and we sweep the place, so we're very diligent." He says, no, but do you, have you got anywhere in your meditation? They say, well, we've got first jhana. And he says, "Well, have you got anything else?" He says, well, we've got second jhana. Anything else? He says, builds it up and it'll become arahants, And then his mates say, "But we never said anything about this." There's just this kind of lovely humility about it through the whole thing. Very sweet.
It's also strange how the Buddha wasn't recognized as being the Buddha by the groundsman, because usually the Buddha's 50 foot tall and there's light shining out of every part of his body. And
that's right, yeah.
It's like, sorry, you're going to bother these guys.
Have you recorded writing or stories or pictures about the nuns and whether they lived in, whether they had any big conflicts or lived more in harmony because they were nuns?
No, but in answer to your question, no, there's not, that I can recall. Any, I mean, yeah, in the kind of the veneer, they have the, oh no, they do, they have a fair amount of squabbles. Yeah, now that I think about it, yeah,
and
the background
story.
They
call each other the most ingratiating things sometimes.
They, yeah, see, this is one of the problems is that see, it's a kind of structural problem is that you've got the Dhamma, which mostly focuses on the Dhamma, right? And then the lifestyle stuff is mostly what you pick up from the vinaya, and of course that's what everyone's all the bad monks and the bad nuns is what you actually hear about most of the time, you know. So these kinds of very very beautiful things, you know, depicted in the suttas, where you get the very positive picture, and then in the vinaya, I mean, the vinaya is not exclusively negative by any means, but a lot of it is concerned with misbehavior. And so, yeah, you do have quite a few stories of the nuns having a go at each other and stuff like that, and Chandakali and Chulananda and all the rest of the crew. They had some colourful characters.
There's a group of six for the bhikkhus, and then there's a group of 12.
Mm.
It's mystical numbers, like the upajaya has to be 12 vasa, mm. The group of 12.
Mm.
Very strange. I don't know what the number 12 symbolises.
They have the
I'm not sure.
Mm.
Yes.
And then for the yaga,
what realm are they in? Usually understood that they're in the Chaturmaharajika, Deva realm. Yes, it's the four great kings. And of the four great kings, one of them is the Yaka king, one of them is the Naga king. One of them is the, I think, the Garuda,
mm-hmm.
Garuda king, and what's the other one? Is the
Gandhava
king. So they're like, that's in the kind of one of the lower heaven realms.
Gandhavas are the musicians.
Does that mean that in the heaven realms there are people with evil intentions? Is that what it's meant?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah. Because the Yakas are definitely a mixed mob. You know, I mean, some of them are okay, and then some of them are pretty bad.
Like the one who tried to hit Venerable Sariputta over the head.
Yeah, that was not.
Give him a blow.
That
I
was.
I think you should do this. Though. I said, give him a blow. Bad
news. Yeah.
So there are four lower realms described by the names of the kings. That's what you just said.
Yeah.
And they're called the lower heaven realms, and that's where the actual.
Yeah, because they've. Yeah. Yeah, and sorry, I should come back actually. Something I mentioned before, I was talking about how the adoption of this Yaka or Yakini cult within the monasteries, and so you know you would have had the local Yakini, Hariti or Kunti or whatever, whose shrine is in the monastery, and then children would be offered to the monastery in her name, as it were, okay, to live there temporarily, and it perhaps wouldn't be too surprising if a certain amount of those children were to actually stay on, right, and to become monks. And it's also not impossible that in some cases that it might not actually be sure whose children they were. Yeah? And so you might get orphaned or abandoned or lost children or something, ending up being put into the monastery and being understood as being the sons of the goddesses. Yeah? Either through some kind of mischance like that, or through perhaps just being dedicated under that name. And this, of course, was also quite common and known in the Greek myths, where children who were, I mean, in the Western cultures, in some cases you had like the actual fertility cults going on in the monastery, so you had like the ritualized temple prostitution and so on, and so the children who were born of that would be dedicated to the temple. But also you had like children who might be lost or abandoned and so on, who were left in the temple and adopted and brought up as, quote, the sons of the god or the daughters of the goddess or whoever it may be. And so one thing that I noticed when I was doing my research about early Buddhism is that you've got the very, very first names, see if I can find the actual names here, that you have of monks. We know very little about the Sangha in the early years. We've got various legends and things, but we don't know how reliable those things are. And so the very first actual inscriptural evidence with names of monks on it is from the Sanchi Stupa, okay, which is dated around 150 to 100 BC. Okay, so we're talking like 300 years after the Buddha, a bit over 100 years after Ashoka. Now, and in those inscriptions, which were recovered and reported about 100 years ago, a bit over 100 years ago, there's names of a number of monks. And what I noticed, which I thought was very interesting, is I'm just trying to find the actual names of the monks here.
Would there be one of the essays from them?
The concept of the offering of children to the temple, the young boys would become novices. What would happen to the girls? And possibly this touches upon a concept of early ordination we were discussing last night for bhikshuni,
bhikkhuni
ordination.
It poses a huge problem in logistics. How would they have solved it?
What do you mean?
Well, babies need nappies, need 24-hour care.
I don't know if they were babies. They're probably
toddlers.
Yeah. Oh no, you've maybe even older than that. Whatever. Kids or whatever. You don't really know. That's why there were the whole series of allowances made for them. You know, precisely for that reason, because they did need a lot of looking after. Where I put the names of the monks. So these are the teachers. So what you have here, and this is very important. This is the actual whole key which has unlocked the entire history of Indian Buddhism. It's almost not an exaggeration to say that, because before they found these inscriptions at Sanchi, They were totally, this is like in the 19th century, they're totally questioning everything about Buddhism. The Buddha was an Ethiopian sun god, right? He was, you know, everything was up for grabs, and there was no agreement about even the vague, within 1,000 years of when the Buddha lived, or whether he actually existed, or anything like this. And this is all being questioned by the European scholars, okay? And you have these Sri Lankan chronicles and histories, and they were being basically dismissed by a lot of the scholars and saying that they were just full of legends and so on, had no truth to them. And then they went and dug up these inscriptions. And these are a list of names found in the Sri Lankan chronicles and also in the commentary, the Vinaya commentary. These monks were sent, according to that commentary, to the Himalayan region as Dhamma missionaries in the time of King Ashoka. So we're talking about 250 BC. And their names are Majjhima, Kassapa Gotra, Alavaka Deva, Sahadeva, and Lundubhisara. And there's some. These names also found in the Chinese translation of the Sinhalese Vinaya commentary. And then they dug up these inscriptions, and they found these inscriptions with the same set of names on them, right? And not only that, but it actually says that they were the teachers of all the Himalayas, okay? Sabahaimavatacharya, okay? The teachers of all the Himalayan region were the same monks, and the same monks, and these are found in Sanchi. Sanchi is find a map of Sanchi. I'll just find this for you so you can see where it is. It is. It's like the Rosetta Stone from India. So I'll come back to that in a minute when it's loaded. Oh, here we go. So this is the central region of India, the Magadha and Vajji and so on, where the Buddha lived most of the time. Kosala is where he was born. Now these inscriptions that we're just looking at were found in Sanchi, which is down here. I was trying to find it exactly on the map to see if it's got the name there. Anyway, it's in this region here, Avanti, this kind of region around about here. Don't know if it's got the exact Vidisa. Oh, here we go, Vidisa. Yeah, that Vidisa is the place. Sanchi is like a suburb next to Vidisa. So here's Ajanta and Ellora further south. So you see, it's like on the southwestern road. Okay, so this was one trade route which is leading down to the ports down here, where they would have the trade with the West. And so this is one of the trade routes. This is the what they call the Dakshinapatha, the southern road, and then the Uttarapatha, the northern road up here.
The so Aryans are up in the top left.
The Aryans?
There's Arya up here.
Ah, I don't know. It's probably the word Aryan, yeah, but that's Iran. The word Iran is just a pronunciation of Arya.
Mm-hmm.
As is Arya, as in Ireland. Ireland means Aryan land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Eva, if you want to contradict me, you look up your dictionary first. And here's, of course, the Himalaya is up here. So they were, in the time of Ashoka, they were missionaries in here, in Magadha. And according to the Sinhalese account, Mogali Putit has organized the missions. And he sent this group of five monks up to the Himalayan region. He sent Dhammarakita up to Gandhara up here. There's Gandhara up here. Majandika was sent to Kashmir, and various others were sent to various places, and of course Mahinda was sent to Sri Lanka, and Sona and Uttara were sent to Suvarnabhumi, which according to the Burmese is Burma, according to the Thais is Thailand. It is a lot of walking, yeah, but I mean in Ashoka's time that was all part of his kingdom. You know, so the Ashokan kingdom was almost that entire area except for a bit down the bottom, a bit down there. And, you know, Sri Lanka was more or less a you know, I mean, they weren't conquered by Ashoka, but they were certainly very close allies. So, yeah, it was a huge, vast kingdom. And so, you know, it's not sure whether, you know, exactly all the details that's talked about in that account are literally true, but nevertheless... So they questioned it. The early scholars were questioning this, and they said, "Oh no, it's a load of rubbish." But then, of course, they found these names, and then they began to realize, "Well, actually, maybe there is something to it. Maybe these fellows did actually go out and see Majima." And so these are different reliquaries, and they found these in the stupas, and how the stupas were arranged so that you'd have the central stupa, of course, is the one with the Buddha image, the Buddha relics, okay, at Sanchi. Which I could probably also find for you on there. Sanchi Stupa. That'll be in Wikipedia. So here's the stupa at Sanchi. Okay. Down here. Sangha period. So this is where these reliquaries were found. By General Taylor, first to document it in 1818. Amateur archaeologists had ravaged the site. And then under George Marshall was the... 1912 to 1919, and so.
And they hadn't been looted or anything all that time.
Well, it probably had been to some degree, but the stupa is massive. The main stupa is huge, so it's a bit difficult to loot it. They was it Cunningham? Who was that one? Marshall. Dug into there. He tried to find the Buddha relics, but they could never find them. So the Buddha relics are almost certainly still in there. That's the main stupa. And the arrangement of it, there were several stupas and things. This is the major one, but they would have the major stupa, and then next to that they would have two smaller stupas, which were for Sariputra and Moggallana. Okay? And so then the smaller ones is where they actually got the relics for Sariputra and Moggallana out, which are the relics that we found, that we actually held when we were in Bodh Gaya, when we were there. So they would take out of here, yeah. And so these are the actual relics of Sariputra and Moggallana. Right? And then, so they were like the secondary ones. But then around them they had these smaller stupas. Right? So, and that was where they found the reliquaries for these other monks. Okay, so you've got like the Buddha is the kind of the central thing. And then you have the great disciples. And then you've got the other monks who were not necessarily all that well known outside of that region. They were like the kind of the local saints, the local heroes. They weren't acknowledged everywhere, like Sariputra and Moggallana. Someone in Kashmir or Sakyan Republic or something had never heard of these guys, yeah, or only vaguely heard of them. And so this is where you're starting to see where the different centres, the Buddhist centres, because obviously you've got a massive kind of support base to be able to do this. This isn't just put up by a few monks, you know, we've got nothing better to do with their spare time. You've obviously got royal support to be able to do that. And, you know, a massive amount of lay support and so on. And so they've got this kind of centre which is built up, which is partly developing like the cult, the local cult of their own local monks, yeah? And, you know, similar way that you find, for example, you know, now in Thailand, you know, Ajahn Chah, for example, is very popular all over Thailand, but especially, of course, in his hometown, Ubon Ratchathani, you know, that's where the big stupa is for him and so on and so forth. So there's like this localization where he's regarded as a great saint in that region, whereas others in different parts of the Theravadan Buddhist world might not also regard him as a saint. So you can see this is one of the forces which is leading to the evolution of the sects and the different schools, that they get their own teachers who'd be revered within their own particular context. And so these monks, Majjhima's Majjhima, Kosiniputta. Now here you have Kassapa Gotō, who's also called Kotiputta. Now I notice that Kotiputta sounds to me a bit like the word we had before, we had Kunti. Now the story of Kunti, remember, she was one of these Yakshinis. Her two sons were actually supposed to have gone. She was actually a tree deva in one particular version in the Pali, and her sons came and ordained as monks. Okay, and then we
had along with the woodland men.
Yeah, yeah, and then her sons became monks, and then we find that an actual name, Kotiputta. This is just a variant spelling of Kunti, is Kotiputta. Okay, is here as on the thing. Now we have Alavaka Deva or Alavagira, but also you have this Alavaka, the Yaka, another very famous Yaka, who was a child-eating monster, was also called Alavaka. Right? Seems a bit kind of strange, doesn't it?
Madura, isn't it?
Sorry?
Madura,
Alavaka, I'm not sure where Alavaka was. And then you have, and then here we have Haritiputta, the son of Hariti. Yeah? So all these, you think all these monks are actually the sons of monsters? And if you found one of them, you wouldn't.
Don't tell my mum this.
No, yeah, don't mention this to my mum. She's coming this week. If you saw just one of them, you wouldn't think, you know, wouldn't think about it. But you see, actually, there's quite a few. And for all we know, these other ones, Kosini, I'm not sure, but these other ones maybe also, Mogali is more. It's a very common name. So I suspect or wonder whether these were the names of monks who were offered, perhaps as young boys, as like an offering at these Yaka shrines, who later on went to become monks, or in some way anyway, that they're associated with these names.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
That is an amazing story. I'm ready. Is it a Himalaya area?
Mm. It's said that they taught there, but these reliquaries are found a long way from the Himalayas. We saw the where are we now? Oops, I think I lost my. There you go. Found a long way from the Himalayas, so this is where those stupas were. So it seems that at some time they came back there, or their relics were brought back. Perhaps they originated in that region. Yeah, they came originally from there and then were sent as missionaries to the Himalayas, but they kept their connection with their hometown. Yeah? And so after their death, then their relics were brought back to their hometown, perhaps. Or perhaps they went as missionaries to the Himalayas for a period of time, and then later on they came to Sanchi and lived there for a period of time afterwards. Yeah? So it's not exactly sure how their relics ended up there. The other interesting point about is Sanchi or Virisa is also the hometown of Mahinda, that brought Buddhism to Sri Lanka. And so he, after the Third Council, he actually spent some time in Sanchi in that same area before coming down to Sri Lanka. Yeah.
He is the son of
Asoka. His mother was from Virisa. Yeah.
It's a long walk to Sri Lanka.
I don't think they had to walk.
So what do you think of relics? Have you seen them actually being formed after someone's come out?
I've never seen them being formed, no.
But you actually held what you took to be Sariputta and
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Was it a good moment?
Oh, of course. Fantastic.
Giving of the Vikuni Training Center.
Yeah.
Is everyone allowed to do that? Or?
Oh God, no. No. These were interred in a vault underneath the floor with slabs over the top and hidden with padlocks and grates, where they'd been put the previous week. The Dalai Lama had put them in there, and they were locked away for nobody could get into them at all.
Well, how did you?
We snuck in there late at night. No, we went with Bhante Sivali, who's the head of the Mahabodhi Society in Bodh Gaya. And he just got the keys and got the monks and lifted it up and opened it up and went down there and took them out. I don't think anything special. Yeah. In terms of appearance.
I felt so bad when I destroyed your relics over there.
So, have there been other texts other inscriptions they found that as to the teachings of any of the Buddhist sutras later been inscribed on stone and have been found so that you could say it's really old teaching?
Not only a few phrases. Probably the earliest phrase would be on the Ashokan pillars, where you have Iha Buddha Jate, which is a quote from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, here the Buddha was born. And then from a period, from this period, the Sanchi period. See, in the Sanchi period, you're already talking. That's where you've got the from the Buddha. You have the Ashokan pillars. It's 150 years after the Buddha, and then the Sanchi stupas, and that's it for almost the first 500 years. I mean, there are a few other things, but these are the first major, the earliest. And so this is like now 300 years after the Buddha. So this is full of things like Jataka stories and all kinds of things. So it has these very complex, you can see these very complex inscriptions and sculptures and things all over these things. It says foreigners of Indo-Greek appearance and so on that it mentions in Sanchi. And very complex carvings. Now a lot of those carvings in different places would be telling stories of Jataka stories and things like that, and they've been identified in a lot of these decorations, and they might have some short inscriptions from scriptures, but usually the only inscription which they have, which is repeated hundreds if not thousands of times, is the saying that about from Asaji to Sariputta, that those things which have arisen from a cause, the great summon has told their arising and their cessation. So this is the great epitome of the Dhamma, which is found in hundreds of inscriptions, but I'm not aware of any larger scale stone inscriptions from that period. As far as I'm aware, the earliest scriptural relics are from the Gandhari manuscripts, which are dated about 200 years after this Sanchi stupa.
That was on the pillars, all things in the court.
Is that on the Ashoka pillars? I can't recall it being actually on the Ashokan pillars, but it's on a lot of inscriptions, like on in Sanchi and other places. Yeah, it's very, very widespread.
That's a very interesting line where your arrows sit in, just above where the arrows sit in, on
these stone carvings. The Buddha was never depicted as a human figure. Instead, the artist chose to represent him by certain attributes, such as the horse on which he left his father's home, his footprints, or a canopy under the Bodhi tree at the point of his enlightenment. The human body was thought to be too confining for the Buddha. That last sentence is very controversial. There's actually no scholarly agreement on why that's the case, but certainly the earliest inscriptions at Sanchi and Amaravati and other places, they didn't represent the Buddha in a human image. And yeah, it's very nice. But we're not really sure. I mean, intuitively it seems easy enough, like why they didn't do it. But if you try to pin it down, there's not a lot of agreement as to exact reasons why.
Like Islam has the temple calligraphy, they don't have the...
Yeah.
Can it be due to the Mahayana belief?
What?
For the people, the teaching around here, they embrace the Mahayana.
No, this would be earlier than Mahayana, yeah. Yeah, this is like the beginnings of the inscription, so it says they were built after 270 BCE, that's the gateways and the balustrade. So obviously the stupa itself would have to have been considerably before that. So this would be about the beginnings of Mahayana, would have been around about beginning about this time. But I don't know if there's any actual Mahayanist, direct Mahayanist influence on the Sanchi stupa.
It just doesn't seem to have any of those deities and stuff which you usually find in Mahayana. Like,
yeah.
Expect a big Kuan Yin somewhere, but not there.
They may not have represented Buddha's body, but there are two of Buddha's hairs in the stupa at Bhante Mahinda's stupa, Aloka.
Yeah, well, yeah, they obviously they had the relics. There was a big.
You have three little teeny ones.
Yeah, the there's a big controversy in Singapore when I was there, because they just built it like a $20 million temple to house a tooth, which was supposed to be a Buddha's tooth, and there's a lot of controversy. Yeah, $20-30 million or something like that. They just built it, and the kind of the interview with the monk is like, you know, how did you verify this thing? I mean, he just spent $20 million on this temple. He said, I don't know. This monk, you know, from Burma. This monk, Burmese monk, gave me this tooth, which was from an old stupa in Burma, and you know, he said it was a tooth relic of the Buddha. So then he built a $20 million temple to house this thing, and they asked dentists, and they said it's a buffalo tooth.
Carbon dated.
Yeah. It's a bit sad. I mean, people were all kind of asking when I was over there last time, because it was an article in the paper. It was actually in the main paper in Singapore when I went there, from the front page that day. So Angie and that, they all kind of asked me about it, and I said, well, you know, if I want to know about the Four Noble Truths, I'll go to a monk. If I want to know about teeth, I'll go to a dentist. So should have got to sit there, to go there and give consultation.
Animal too.
So this is just some of the carvings and things. You see, it's obviously quite amazing work.
How far away is this from Gaya?
Not a huge amount.
If you could take all the relics which were supposedly attributed to the Buddha, I mean, it's probably enough to fill this room.
Oh, you can fill a whole $20 million temples.
Everybody's got a Buddha relic here,
though. Okay. So, here you are.
The popular reading Sri Devadatta out of last week.
Mm-hmm.
Can I borrow it or read the story?
Yeah, of course. Where was I reading from Devadatta? Yeah, it's in Yes, in the jewel one. The other very convenient source for reading that is also Nyanamoli's Life of the Buddha.
Oh, okay.
And he does a really he's got the most translations in there.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivādi svākhāto Bhagavata Dhanu Dhanvanamasam Supatipanna Bhagavato Sarvaka Sangha